Okay, let's fire at will here. The bar is open here. Order up. Ms. Reed. Yes.
Would you case?
Yes. Yeah, as well you could be, and one of the reasons why we devote a whole chapter to it, chapter 6, is because of all of the permutations and combinations that you could do with joint and several liability. I think for your purposes now, the important thing to remember is the fact that at least with respect to that form of market share liability, the court said it will be a purely several liability. Each defendant will be liable only for their individual share, contrasted with Summers versus Tice, where each defendant's liable for the whole. So it could make a big difference to the plaintiff. It's one of the reasons why you would prefer a Summers versus Tice alternative liability theory, if you can swing it, compared to being stuck with market share liability. And I have in the past given exam fact patterns where it sounded like market share liability, but as it turns out, you could identify each of the potentially responsible defendants, and Summers versus Tice was available. And so one of the things I hoped to see would be the student's analysis saying, well, gee, the first thing I try would be Summers versus Tice, and if I could swing that, do it. If I couldn't manage that, then I'd, you know, move next to the market share. But many people were, again, so ready to trot out all the stuff on market share liability, they just blew right past the better alternative for their client. Again, all of the different variations on joint and several liability and the different policy ways to split it will come back in Chapter 6. Most of that, as it turns out, is driven by statutes rather than common law. Part of the reason is because through a statute you can make arbitrary kinds of directions that wouldn't work out as well if you were trying to, as a court, come up with some principle. Yes?
In a case where, in a Cardozo-type jurisdiction where negligence per se has been established,
yes,
does the defense still use the mere chance to say they're not legally responsible, or would that exclude them from using that?
Well, if I understand your question, it seems to combine the issues of negligence with the issues of causation. And remember that Cardozo was himself clear about the distinction between the two, that as hard-nosed as he was, as controlling of the jury to grab them and, you know, say, you must find the defendant negligent, at least in theory, Cardozo left it open to the jury. He didn't practice what he preached. In Martin versus Herzog, he went ahead and overrode the jury with respect to causation, but in his words, at least, he acknowledged the fact that the causation inquiry has to be kept separate. So if whether because of a lack of but-for causation, or for that matter, a lack of legal causation, you can't find that the negligence of the defendant caused the plaintiff's injury, you can't, in effect, borrow all of this, you know, certainty that you have about negligence and sprinkle a little bit of it over in the causation area, you're essentially, you know, there's sort of a non-transferable asset over here. And the certainty about negligence doesn't solve your problem with respect to causation. Yes, Ms. Peterman.
I just want to make sure that I understand. Okay, when you have lost a chance,
I'll put it the other way around. That is, if you don't have a 50% or greater chance, then you're stuck trying to do loss of a chance.
So the typical way that I present this in a fact pattern on an exam is I give you a fact pattern sort of like Hardy versus Southwestern Bell, where you have, in the facts, a less than 50% chance of survival. In which case, you then say, gee, my only alternative, since the plaintiff can't meet this more probably than not standard, my only alternative is to hope that the jurisdiction would recognize a loss of a chance theory. Does that make sense? If, by contrast, the evidence supports a finding that this is a cause which more probably than not is one without which the injury would not have occurred, more probably than not it is a but-for cause of the injury, then I don't want to mess with loss of a chance. Let me just also make it clear that if you are entitled to a loss of a chance theory, all you get is the value of that chance. So the analogy that I encourage you to use is this idea of a lottery ticket. You know, I've got a chance of getting a bunch of money out of this, but I have to discount the face value of this lottery ticket. You know, a winning ticket's worth $50,000, but the chance is only 1 in 4 that this is a winning ticket. So, assuming I did succeed in a loss of a chance case, I'd only get that percentage of the overall loss that was suffered. Okay, now you had a question about medical malpractice. Medical malpractice is the one area where loss of a chance has been successfully used. Once you get outside the medical malpractice area, the courts seem to take a much more hostile view. The things that make it attractive in the medical malpractice area don't apply in these other areas. We don't have the same level of statistical records about, and each case is different. Even though every patient is a little bit different in the medical context, we still keep statistics on people with kidney failure and people with this and people with that, what their survival rates are. We can't use the same approach if we're talking about intersection collisions or, you know, chemical factory explosions, because each one of those cases is unique and different, and so the statistical information we use to generate loss of a chance information simply isn't available in other areas. That's to name it. Well, let's sort of run a typical scenario. You represent the plaintiff. You're trying to establish liability. You've walked through all of your negligence issues, as we would in Hardy. You know, what would a reasonable person do operating a 911 system? So I've done all my Chapter 1 analysis. I then get to Chapter 2. The question I want to ask is, with what level of certainty can I say that this negligent act I've identified over here caused the plaintiff's injury? And in some cases, like running a red light, it's a no-brainer. You know, the probability is to a moral certainty. Hey, if you hadn't run the red light, you wouldn't have been in this intersection collision case. In other cases, it's more doubtful. So, for example, in the kid falling off the bridge, you know, what evidence do I have that, but for the defendant's negligence, there would have been a better result. Maybe the chances are very good, maybe the chances are very poor, the kid would have survived in the absence of the defendant's negligence. So I just make an assessment of that, and if looking at that evidence, I say, well, gee, I don't foresee a real problem for the plaintiff establishing a but-for cause here. You know, drunken boyfriend shows up at Kmart. It's the last store open. He said, gosh, I've been everywhere else in town. You're the only guys that are open. I need to buy a hunting rifle. I'm going with my pals tomorrow morning to go deer hunting. You know, okay, so here's your deer rifle. What are the odds, you know, how probable is it that if the clerk had said, excuse me, Mr. Jones, but we'd love to serve you in the morning when you're... But we don't sell, we don't sell to people that are under the influence. If that had happened, would she have, would the girlfriend have survived that? If you say, yeah, as a matter of fact, I think the odds are pretty good. Now, I have to consider the other, is there other evidence that if he couldn't shoot her with a gun, he was going to stab her with a knife or, you know, whack her over the head with a baseball bat or whatever it was that he had in mind? Maybe we could say, hey, whether he had a rifle or he had some other implement, the same harm was going to befall the plaintiff. But again, you simply look at the fact pattern to see what evidence is given to me about the likelihood that this injury could have been avoided. If I think the likelihood is high, I simply say, we put it to the jury and say, but for this person's negligence, no harm. Actually, you move on to the stuff we're about to cover, which is, wait a minute, in addition to being a but-for cause, is it also a legal cause? Is it fair to blame Kmart for what, after all, the boyfriend did? Is he, as the language goes in the section we're about to cover, a superseding cause? If I, as a social host, furnish alcohol to my social guests, am I legally liable for the accidents they cause when they're out on the highway? There may be a public policy that says people who provide alcohol on a social basis are not liable for the misuse of alcohol by their guests. Contrasted, of course, with the liability for a commercial host. If you run the, Davenport Hotel and you overserve people who are already intoxicated, you are legally liable. So, again, we've made this policy judgment. Whether it's good or bad is another question, but I want to be alert to the fact that something that is the same relationship, negligently giving alcohol to someone you shouldn't give alcohol to, in one context that's found to be a legal cause of the injury, in another scenario which looks the same except for the social commercial distinction, you say, no, that's not a cause of the injury. It's the drinking that was a cause of the injury. So, in that legal cause area, again, you want to sort of filter the facts through the question, is this an increased risk, as distinguished from a mere chance? Is this a superseding cause of the injury? Did it occur in a reasonably foreseeable way? The Falsgraf case that we get to at the end of the chapter. So, then you would move on to the damages question. Yeah. Springfield, yeah.
If the defendant found negligent or strictly liable, but it was not a proximate cause, they completely absolved.
Correct.
Okay.
Because the plaintiff's burden again is breach of duty, proximately caused, damages. If I can't satisfy any one of those hoops, I'm not entitled to recover as a plaintiff. Kendall.
On this information about the unknown identity.
Yes.
Trying to kind of understand these four blocks and get them distinguished. I think I'm understanding. understanding that this is used when, you know, the plaintiff can't really determine the identity of the defendant. But can you kind of speak about maybe some of these, especially the enterprise liability, and
okay,
how they apply and what kind of the distinguishing factors in each one?
Yeah, you did a good thing in the beginning to make sure we've correctly identified the problem. Before I provide a solution, I want to make sure I've correctly identified the problem. And the problem in each of these four areas is there is a defendant out there who negligently caused the plaintiff's injury. The problem I'm having is, for whatever reason, I can't identify them. I don't have fingerprints at the scene. I don't have a brand label, you know, on the blasting cap. It blew up along with the plaintiff's hand. I've got a great case except for this missing identity piece. There are four different scenarios in which I can get around that. The first is this idea of alternative liability. Each of the defendants acted negligently. Again, Summers versus Tice is this classic visual image. They're firing at the plaintiff. I just can't tell which one fired the bullet that put my eye out. Where I can get all of the players identified in the courtroom, I'm dealing from a full deck, and I can show they're all negligent, then I'm entitled to alternative liability, or, you know, to shifting that burden of proof. Again, remember, there may be cases in which I can get all the defendants, but I can't show they were all negligent. That's why I can't, if I go out and discover my parked car got swiped by somebody coming around the corner, I can't name all the, you know, licensed drivers who were in Spokane. One of them was negligent, but not all of them. Okay, so that's alternative liability. Second theory is concert of action. And the key idea there is a prior agreement. When I was in college, somebody discovered that you could take surgical tubing and water balloons and make sort of a slingshot and launch these water balloons. And on a, you know, warm day, it seemed like a fun thing to do, to sort of have a balloon war in which these artillery shots were launched from one end of the campus to the other. Well, if somebody gets, you know, clonked by one of these water balloons, a civilian in this military campaign, can they sue the people who were engaged in this activity? Yes. What if you can't tell whose balloon it was that caused the injury? Well, the theory would be that to the extent that you had a common agreement beforehand launching this negligent activity, like the drag race, where they put one another up to this negligent activity, then they all become, in effect, agents of one another. The fact that I can't identify which one launched the particular balloon doesn't prevent me from essentially holding them collectively liable. Again, the key part of that is the whole notion of prior agreement. Simply doing the same thing is not enough. If we're all speeding down the highway, not pursuant to an agreement, but simply because it's all to our individual advantage, that's not concert of action. It has to be, you know, there has to be, in contract language, some sort of meeting of the minds. But if there is, we don't need to have all the players. I may be down to three people out of 50 who were engaged in this balloon war, but if those three joined with the others, they become liable for negligently launching this campaign. So again, alternative liability means I've got to be dealing with a full deck, even if I don't have any prior agreement. Concert of action means I have to have prior agreement even if I'm not dealing from a full deck. The third theory is enterprise liability, Hall versus DuPont, the blasting cap case. The easiest way I suggested that you understand that is to see it as a sort of mirror image of the concert of action concept. Only this time it's concert of inaction. It's where the defendants are a group, like this trade association, and instead of doing something bad, they fail to do something good, namely to adopt safety procedures or some other positive response to a known danger. And again, at the risk of spoiling all your fun and going through the past exams, I had a case in which there was a guy who was injured by a tire rim being improperly matched with a tire. There are actually a fair number of these cases where you're mounting a tire on a tire rim, and you or the rim, the wheel of the car, and you get them mismatched. And if you do it just right with these high pressure things, you can sort of turns into this kind of like a grenade, and the whole thing blows up with these metal parts flying, causing very serious injuries. And the question was, could you hold the? There was some information about the association of tire manufacturers or wheel manufacturers and how they adopted standards for, you know, sizes. And the question would be, in that situation, were they obligated, using reasonable care, to come up with a system to warn about or otherwise prevent guys who work with tires from getting hurt mismatching a tire rim with a tire? So there again would be a case where enterprise liability is the failure of a group to adopt prudent measures to avoid injuries, like kids getting hurt from blasting caps or guys who change tires from getting sort of exploding tires thrown at. Okay, fourth theory was market share liability. Again, that's characterized by cases in which there is some kind of generic fungible product, asbestos fibers or you know, PVC pipe or some DES or some other kind of substance that's causing harm. And the plaintiff says, I can't get everybody, so alternative liability is out. There's no concert of action, so I can't do a concerted action. There's no trade association, but I could paint you a picture in which each of the participants in this market could be assigned a market share, and I want to hold them liable for their share of this market in which they have negligently marketed a product without warning about it or testing it, or there's some other liability theory, some Chapter 1 theory to show they were negligent. And then, in fairness, they should only pay their share of the total picture of the damages that they've caused. And if you're close enough to the Sindel facts, you get to do market share liability. Again, though, it's got to be some sort of generic fungible product, as opposed to, you know, if I named all the automobile manufacturers, there's a difference between a Honda and a Ford Explorer and a Jeep Cherokee and Suburban, and you know, each car, they're not like fungible products here. They're different. Mr. Rubio?
Just going back to enterprise liability, do you need to be dealing from a full deck?
No, you don't. If you had a full deck, if you had all the defendants who caused the plaintiff's injury, you wouldn't bother with enterprise liability having to show the existence of some trade association that was small enough, etc., you'd go right back to number one, alternative liability. So enterprise liability applies in situations where, as in Hall versus DuPont, they didn't have a full deck, but they did have a substantial number of this small industry
or the, you know, small number of players in this industry. Again, it was part of the distinguishing feature in Sindel. Why it didn't apply, it wasn't a small collection in Sindel, and they didn't have the means of imposing some sort of standards for safety. Yeah. Well, again, this would be a classic Chapter 6 question. Assuming I'm going to hold one of these people liable for the whole thing, what remedies does that person have to bring in the other parties who helped cause it? I'm one of the 50 people whose, you know, fraternity decided to, you know, have this balloon war on campus, along with Bluto and my other, you know, fraternity buddies at Animal House. You know, why am I getting stuck with all of this? And again, in Chapter 6, there are attempts to sort of even it out. But again, the problem in Chapter 6 is how do we balance the inequity to the defendant of making the defendant pay more than their fair share against the concern that the plaintiff not be denied a full recovery so that, you know, I'm the waiter for a table of 25, and suddenly I discover it's separate checks, and a lot of the people are off dancing, and you know they've all split. And I said, well, wait a minute, I thought you were all together here, and I need to get paid. So again, balancing all those sorts of things are the tough issues we take up in Chapter 6. But for our purposes here, again, the good news about concert of action is it is a collective responsibility. Each individual essentially says, by joining in this group, you essentially became responsible for all the stupid things they do. And if you can track them down, go ahead and even it up with them. But if you can't, that's not the plaintiff's problem, it's your problem. Ms. Reed.
Kind of parallel industry customs, part of the neighborhood part of it, that it's not
I'm flinching a little bit because the industry custom is just sort of an information base that says let's look at the collective experience of these people as a useful window on what a reasonable person would do. Whereas in concert of action, it's more of a legal doctrine of saying, if I join with you to engage in some activity, I mean, this is true in criminal law as well, the whole law of conspiracy in criminal law. You and I decide we're going to rob a bank. You know, we agree, hey, we don't want anybody to get hurt. I don't use a weapon. You don't use a weapon. We just hold our hands in our... I can still, under the law of conspiracy, be responsible for the fact that, contrary to our initial agreement, you go whack the person over the head and cause fatal injuries, you know. So again, the whole notion of collective responsibility that the law takes very seriously when you and I agree together. Whereas industry custom is essentially looking at the wealth of experience as a way of sizing up what is reasonable care, and it's a suggestive rather than this, you know, having the force of law. Jatada.
In the Hardy case, instead of say a problem, an action problem, so say the problem is something like there was a malfunction,
right?
That fall under your medical contract?
Well, to the extent the phone company is not engaged in the practice of medicine, you know, it doesn't really fall within medical malpractice. One of the reasons in Hardy that they thought they might be able to get there from here is that the problem was related to the supply of medical care. So, it wasn't moving the court from here to way over there. It seemed like we're moving the court from here to, you know, the lot next door. And in that sense, it was a more promising form of expansion than something far more ambitious. But it still wasn't medical care, and therefore the court said the principle we apply to health care doesn't transfer here.
Can you explain again why the Purcell case doesn't fall under
Okay. Remember, Purcell was the asbestos case involving the use of the substantial factor test as distinguished from imposing the traditional but-for cause requirement. The facts in Purcell are that each defendant supplies a little bit of asbestos. So amongst these, it might be 12, 15, 20 different defendants. I get a little bit from this guy, a little bit from that guy, a little bit from that guy. That's a different factual scenario from saying one of these 20 people injured me, the other 19 had nothing to do with my injury.
So even though, obviously asbestos is the same, DES it's just because one person or one company administers that DES?
What we know in the Purcell case is that each defendant played a role in the plaintiff's injury. Let me give you another example, and it's one I use in the little tutorial involving the use of alcohol. Suppose I go to six different bars in the course of, I go pub crawling, and I have two beers at each of six different establishments. After I leave the last one, I get into my car and I get into an accident. The victim of that accident, in addition to suing me because I'm driving under the influence, sues the bars they allege served me after I was legally under the influence. Each of the bars say, what's two beers out of, are you telling me that if it weren't for these two beers, there's some old joke, as I recall, about, the first one tastes terrible and the last one gets me drunk. Anyway, something like that. Okay, I can't remember how the joke goes. But if the defendants say the consumption of alcohol from my establishment didn't make the difference, you have to show more probably than not, but for the consumption of these, suppose it's 12 bars that each serves one beer, better case for the defendants. What the law says is, in a case like that where each, it's not so much that we don't know, gee, I wonder which one served the beer that got him drunk. We recognize that the intoxicated state when he left the last bar was due to the combination of each of these. So all we ask is to say, did this defendant's negligence constitute a substantial factor rather than a but-for cause? And that's, again, different from Sindel, where in Sindel it was one and only one. Each of these people acted negligently, but most of their negligence fell harmlessly to the ground. Only one bullet actually struck the plaintiff, and we don't know whose gun it came from.
So Purcell, the distinctive factor here is that he went to several different job sites over 35 years.
And absorbed asbestos from a lot of them. And again, part of the opinion is figuring out what's the bottom threshold here, as it were, in a restaurant. Suppose restaurants served, instead of, standard-sized drinks, they served... We served you Cherry's Jubilee or whatever, and there's a little bit of alcohol, left in the Cherry's Jubilee after we burned most of it off in this flaming dish I set on your table. Well, if there were different amounts of, what's the little bit of alcohol that would be necessary to even be a proper defendant in a case like that? Certainly serving one drink to somebody who eventually winds up being intoxicated, I think, would satisfy that test. But again, part of the problem in Purcell is you just have to walk by the job site, you have to be in a certain level of proximity, you have to be there for a substantial amount of time, et cetera, et cetera. How clear does the guy's recollection have to be, et cetera. But at some point, once you say, hey, it's in that area where it had something to do with the case, instead of putting the burden on the plaintiff to show, yes, it's a cause without which the injury would not have occurred, we recognize that imposing that test would mean the defendants would all walk away unscathed.
It's that one defendant that did walk away.
Yes. Well, part of what he said was, I never laid a finger on it. My asbestos never got into his lungs. You don't have any proof that even one fiber got into his lungs. And what the court on appeal says is not so fast. The level of exposure in these cases is so modest that it takes to cause this injury. We're essentially going to leave it to the jury to decide, instead of directing the verdict and saying, no, that's not enough. We want to leave it to the jury to say, is this or is this not a substantial factor? So again, if I went to bars and bars gave me, you know, from a little teeny tiny taste up to, a pitcher full of margaritas, that the jury would, in fact, have the freedom to say, well, this is a substantial factor. His blood alcohol content at the time of the accident was 0.18. And this half a drink that he got over here, we say is a substantial factor. And if they say it is, it is. Recognizing that, hey, that by itself wouldn't have made a difference. That by itself wouldn't have gotten him drunk, but in combination, the multiple redundant factor here.
When you're talking about alternative liability and the three criteria the other day, I remember that the
Ms. Townsend, that's
yes.
It, right? Okay.
Yes.
Yeah.
Wow, that's good.
I'm trying to get these, so go ahead.
The third one was a little bit hazy, and also when I was looking at the definitions, they didn't quite all seem to match up so with that.
Okay. I was trying to remember your name, so I didn't want to say anything. Go ahead. What was your name?
Alternative liability.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I never quite... in essence, it's two criteria with an implication.
It would be the easiest way to say it.
The two criteria are, first of all the defendants are negligent. All the potential tortfeasors have been named. Therefore, the implication is the party who caused the defendant's the party who caused the plaintiff's injury is among the defendants in the case. So again, just to kind of nail down that last one to distinguish it from the other cases like Sindel. In Sindel, all the defendants were negligent, but we could not be sure that the party who caused the plaintiff's injury was one of the people who had been named. It could just as well have been one of those bankrupt or other companies that are no longer available to be sued. And therefore, the court said, this is an alternative liability.
But on that, you said, to get all the defendants,
but then you
couldn't prove they were negligent,
you used
the stealing of the car example. What does that
do? Okay. Not so much the stealing of the car, I think I used my car
getting hit.
Getting hit.
Okay.
If I've been hit and I said, or let's suppose I know it was a law student who hit my car. It's parked out here. I can name, I know that among these defendants is the one who caused my injury, but I can't meet the first criterion. Only one of them negligently sideswiped my car. I can't use alternative liability to put all these people in a lawsuit. You first have to show I acted negligently toward you. So the thing in Sindel, the thing in Summers versus Tice is these people are negligently firing in the plaintiff's direction. All of them were negligent. All of them could have caused the injury. We just don't know which it was. As distinguished from a case in which, somebody caused your damage, but it was a one somebody, and the rest of us have nothing to do with it.
Mr. Kendall.
Just one final question.
determine that the jury, I guess, would determine this, that whether it's a substantial factor or not, dealing with, you know, how much alcohol you gave, even if it's a small little amount.
Right.
How do they go about, how does the jury go about, I guess, how would the plaintiff recover the damages? And as long as the jury says that this defendant was a substantial factor, is it allocated to the whole thing, or?
You've essentially hit on a Chapter 6 issue,
okay,
which is with multiple defendants. If there are four bars that are all found to have been a substantial factor, how amongst themselves are they allocated? If he sat in one bar and had two pitchers of margaritas, and he had one beer from another one, you know, would it be fair to say, well, it's 50-50, or do you do, you know, the relative blood alcohol content? Do you figure out how much of it was metabolized? But, you know, you can do all sorts of different things, but again, how we allocate amongst defendants, I want to postpone till Chapter 6. The question now is, can I get a judgment at all?
Okay. And that would come from the jury. The jury would decide what the...
Obviously, a judge at some point would say that, you know, if the restaurant said we served you no alcohol, yeah, but you had a rum cake, you know, and the rum cake had a little bit of rum in it. Well, the judge might say no reasonable jury could say this is a substantial factor. So again, that was the push point in Purcell, in part, was, what's the minimum level at which a reasonable jury could say it's a substantial factor? And the appellate court set that threshold lower than the trial court had to make it easier for the jury to find that. But there will come a point at which the judge is going to say, wait a minute, this isn't even close. Ms. Reed. Yes. Well, again, different jurisdictions could adopt different tests to set that threshold, and the jury actually would be looking for some kind of guidance. I mean, if you sat on a jury, and this was one of my criticisms in Mitchell versus Gonzalez, you give me this test, it's got to be a substantial factor in causing the injury. As a juror, where do I go with that? I don't have any content to that, and I'm just at sea in terms of finding out what that, you know, can you give that a little more specificity here? So again, many jurisdictions with respect to asbestos cases had tried to set a threshold so as they went through the records with, you know, 14 different asbestos companies, which of these meet the criteria and which of them ought to be let go. Other questions? Yes?
The mom purchased that she purchased at a different time.
Yeah,
would that make it different? Would that make it more
sadistic person that I am, I could give you a DES case in which the mother took multiple prescriptions of DES, and suddenly it's no longer a question of which one caused the injury.
It would be more like
it's which ones caused the injury, and so now it's more like Purcell than it is like Sindel.
Then the only way you could get out of it is if you could prove that your DS was not sold anywhere near where she's the guy that proved it, because asbestos could be in.
Well, see, in Purcell, we actually had evidence. I mean, the Sindel case is where I have the foggiest idea who sold the stuff that I was exposed to. In Purcell, I know exactly who sold the stuff. The question is how much evidence, how close do I have to get to it before I've triggered? And then it's the interaction of these different, you know, 18 different exposures, which ones trigger liability. So, again, as I say, I would be even more sadistic than I already am if I tried to put those two together so you would have this overlap and so forth. In Sindel, it's a pretty clean problem of one and only one. In Purcell, it's a problem of multiple people, but whose relative conduct is relatively identified.
In Sindel, it is one and only one, because you're just going to assume that she obviously was prescribed one.
Yeah.
One drug from one manufacturer.
Right.
One and only.
Yeah.
Okay.
She's at risk of having a miscarriage. The doctor prescribes this medication. She takes this medication.
Okay.
That's where it all comes from. So, yeah.
And Del, I'm a little confused. Were there multiple prices as well?
Yes.
So, what, I mean, obviously, some manufacturers sold some medicine to someone.
And it's for that reason that I think the court felt its remedy kind of matched in a rough collective way the ultimate fairness of the liability situation. In effect, if I'm Squibb or Eli Lilly or one of these companies, I'm going to be paying a fraction here and a fraction there and a fraction there. By the time you get done with this class action, adding it all up, I would have paid my fair share. In a perfect world, I would have paid a lot to this person and none to that one. But I think one of the reasons the court thought this was an okay solution is, in the end, the total liability would be proportionate to my fair share. So even though they were playing a little bit fast and loose with the causation requirements, the end result was reasonably fair to the defendants, and it provided a much needed and much deserved remedy to the plaintiffs. So again, that's where the question of the court's willingness to kind of, you know, flex is a question of how far are we, you know, pushing this out of whack, and do we have a corresponding benefit to show for it? Which of course raises the larger question for a court of how much are you bound by the procedural niceties, and to what extent is your job to sort of do the greatest good for the greatest number in a utilitarian sense, and procedures are just a kind of marker along the way. So. Ms. Shoemaker.
In product liability, I know this is going ahead, but is market share liability
Sindel is actually a product liability case, as it turns out. So, yes, the form of liability and market share is often based upon the substantive law of product liability, which we'll pick up in Chapter 9. Okay, have a good weekend. I'll see you exams in hand on Monday.
Thank you.